Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
You're listening to the Daily Maverick Show. My name's Greg Nicholson, filling in for Kingsley Kapoori, who's away again this week. I'm joined by my colleague, Fatima Matiba. How are you doing, Fatima?
I'm good, and you, Greg?
So you went to the EFF second anniversary conference this weekend. How was it?
It was really interesting. It was the first rally that I've ever been to.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of interesting things, a lot of new things that I learned about the EFF and rallies in general.
A lot of singing, a lot of dancing, yeah. A lot of drinking.
A lot of drinking, a lot of quarts in paper bags. That was interesting.
Quarts, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you partake?
I did not. I don't drink, so I couldn't be part of those festivities.
Okay, today we're going to be talking to Mario Masuku, who's the leader of the Swaziland political party, the banned political party Podemo, about his recent release from jail after spending a year in a Swazi prison. After that, we're going to get into some issues on initiation schools. Fatima, you've been looking at this a little bit, where we've seen in recent years throughout the initiation seasons young boys both facing death and also facing amputation of their penises after going through, I guess you'd say, dodgy circumcision practices. So that's going to be coming up in about the second half of the show. But first of all, we're going to be speaking in a moment to Mario Masuku, the Swazi political leader of the opposition party, who they've been quite strident in opposing King Mswati III's regime, and he was recently in prison with another Swazi activist, the youth leader
Maxwell Dlamini.
That's right, Maxwell Dlamini. And I think they're on charges of, what was it, terrorism, sedition and subversion against the Swazi state, largely just for their pro-democracy sort of statements and speaking out against King Mswati's leadership. And so in a moment we'll get him on the line. Before we might actually come back to the EFF a little bit. And it's one of those interesting things, isn't it, Fatima, that we've seen recently. Oh, so do we have Mario on the line? Mario, are you with us?
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Good, thanks, Mario. Thanks for joining us today. First of all, can you just tell us a little bit about, you were released from prison a month ago. Can you tell us a little bit about the charges against you and the fight you've had against that system?
Thank you, Greg. Since the 1980s, I have been part of the people that are calling for a democratization of Swaziland against a regime that does not recognize political party, and indeed it is based on absolutism. We have had people, including myself, been charged for high treason, sedition, and so forth. Lately, in 2008, there was an act put into place called the Suppression of Terrorism Act. I was charged under that in 2008, and I was acquitted in 2009. But this time, in 2014, while I was addressing the May Day, workers on the May Day, I was charged under the same Suppression of Terrorism Act and seditious activities. I have been there for the past 14 months and released on the 14th. Yes, I knew that prison is not a five-star comfort place, but prisons in Swaziland are very, very, very uncomfortable for the people. They're still a little bit backward. I had been while there, we have been trying to get our bail, to be released on bail, but the state continued to say we are a risk, we are a security risk, we are a flight risk, and so forth. But this time, I believe that the pressure within Swaziland and from outside of Swaziland, in particular from our friends, the alliance partners in South Africa and Europe and America, have pushed the regime to ensure that we come out on prison on bail. However, briefly, it is that I feel that our task is still incomplete. My coming out of bail does not mean that the suppression of the freedom of expression, association and assembly will go away. We will continue fighting on. Coming out to be here, I still feel I'm just like a free bird in a cage. Mm-hmm. The struggle goes on. But I'm grateful to all comrades and people who have been in solidarity with our cause in Swaziland.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you just take us back to that May Day rally? What did you say that brought on these charges?
Well, I did say that the kind of government, which is the Tinkunla government system in Swaziland, is undemocratic and it will not deliver the wishes of the people. And I did also say that the country has lost opportunities like the African Growth Opportunities Act, that's ACOA. It is due to the incompetence of the government of Swaziland, and that our working class in Swaziland is so suppressed that the ILO has placed Swaziland into near sanctions status. It is because of this government. And I did say that it needs an immediate transformation. We need a change in Swaziland. And this is, of course, I did mention that I am a member of PUDEMO, the People's United Democratic Movement, which is a banned political party as far as Swaziland is concerned. Those are the charges that were placed on us.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about the robust level of political debate in South Africa, what you said doesn't seem like much to go to jail for. It sort of says a lot about the Swazi system.
Well, you see, the problem that we always have is that countries, in particular SADC, have always upheld the issue of sovereignty, not wanting to interfere with internal issues of any country. But I think in South Africa, I am convinced that there are organizations, there are individuals who know how suppressive such regimes can be, are supportive, and they are in solidarity with our cause. I feel humbled, and I'm definitely sure we will arrive at a place where Swaziland will be regarded as one of civilized countries in the region, the continent, and the world at large. Mm-hmm. But indeed, we are seeking for a country governed by the will of the people through a multi-party democracy.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about your time while you were in prison. You mentioned that the conditions weren't five-star. What was it like in there, and what did you learn about the Swazi prison system?
Firstly, I must say that the prisons take side. I believe that the executive, judiciary, and indeed legislative are independent arms of any government. But here, the prisons and personnel in there regarded us as enemies, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, the everything in Swaziland, all these institutions are placed towards the monarchy, which is the executive. For instance, they are called His Majesty's Correctional Services.
Really?
The police are called the Royal Swaziland Police, and they are bound to be closer to the executive. So if it is heard that we are saying the government here is undemocratic and it needs changes. They see us as enemies of the state. So that was very difficult for us. Besides that, of course, the conditions that we were sleeping almost on the floor, because it was a mat, we're sleeping on a mat of about 1 centimeter in width. The conditions, the windows there could not close, and winter did its toil on us. And I was not allowed to see a private medical practitioner of my choice. It was difficult. My friends were not allowed to see us as they wished to. My legal team, my advocate, senior advocate, and Mary DeForce from South Africa, had to stand outside there for over 30 minutes to see us, only for about 10 minutes, to see us for 10 minutes. You see the intimidation that is there. We were not allowed inside when we are visited by friends to discuss political matters. We, you know, it was so different. We were really found, we were already serving a sentence in there. It was a difficult. At the last time, when we were in the maximum security cell, we were not allowed to move around. We were locked in the cells, and we were using a bucket for ablution. It was so difficult. It was so inhumane until such time that we raised the issue and the international community were responsive to what we were doing. It was not right for us as political prisoners.
So much of what you say actually reminds me of stories of apartheid political prisoners, and it makes me wonder, did you get interrogated a lot? Did you ever get tortured while in prison?
No, not physically. We were not physically tortured, but the way we were treated, we were placed in isolation, and whatever we did, prisoners in there were told never to speak to us, not to communicate with us. Our ways were such, when we went to the courts to for anything, whether I went for hospital or to the courts, there was always armed security with all the blares and all the noise, you know, intimidating the public to note that these are dangerous people. I think there is no less torture than that.
Now, looking forward, what is next for the pro-democracy movement in Swaziland? Because it seems like the pro-democracy movement continues to stand up to Mswati's governance and rule and continues to fight for multi-party democracy and the rights for freedom. But it seems that it's hard to quantify the gains that have been achieved. I know every April we see the Global Week of Action on Swaziland, and every time it seems like the police crack down on them. What needs to happen next to promote democracy in Swaziland?
Firstly, Greg, I think it must be noted that we will not claim easy victories. Nevertheless, there are issues or marks that show that there have been some victories in this long battle. Firstly, it is the People's United Democratic Movement, PUDEMO, in 1992, who called for a constitutional dispensation in Swaziland. Although the process of forming the constitution was too flawed, but there is a constitution. So that is a gain. That we spoke, the people of Swaziland spoke loudly about the loosening of the chains of the workers and federations and so forth. It has gained some benefits. As you know now, we now have a federation called the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, TUKOSWA, which was deregistered at some time by the regime. So there are some gains. It is us that have been calling for a democratic dispensation, and the government is doing reforms, but those are just cosmetic. However, moving forward, we believe that people must understand, in as much as monarchies are undemocratic, I will not talk about an absolute monarchy for that matter. Mm-hmm. Monarchies normally are undemocratic. We are prepared to go further as a united political parties moving forward towards a negotiated settlement. We are not for any violence, even though the regime's security forces respond by violence and more violence. That would be the last for us. We are prepared to say what the people of Swaziland want. We want a proper transformation, total transformation, and economy that is for the people, culture that is for the people. It is not that we want to throw everything away. And therefore, we are ready to discuss, go to a dialogue with anybody who is a real patriot of Swaziland for a free and democratic country of ours.
But speaking of a negotiated settlement, is there any chance of that while we have Budemo banned, TUKOSWA deregistered?
Any negotiated settlement is predetermined by the will of all the people and organizations concerned. And therefore, I believe if we are going to discuss any negotiated settlement, the first thing that needs to be done, it is to unban political parties. Mm-hmm. Secondly, is to review all undemocratic laws. And then everyone should, come forward and agree and be ready for the negotiation. Mm-hmm. No negotiations can be successful when the table is not free and conducive for a political dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Now, here in Johannesburg, we have different groups that definitely show quite a lot of support for Swaziland's pro-democracy movement. But you mentioned earlier before that in the SADC region, most governments have decided to respect the sovereignty of different nations and Swaziland's own ability to make up and determine its own future. Would you call on the South African government or other governments to take a stronger stance on Swaziland?
I should think the South African government in particular has learned many lessons. The first lesson that the South African government has learned is through its own experience. For South Africa to be democratic, it called on for the region, it called on the continent and the international community to call on the apartheid regime to acknowledge that change has to come. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that South Africa and the SADC region has not learned clearly from the Burundi massacre of people there. We are not again ready to see blood flowing in any country of this world, let alone in SADC. I therefore believe that South Africa as a neighbor must be ready and must be seen to be assisting, a catalyst towards a democratic dispensation in Swaziland. If some people don't understand what we are seeking for, I think the door is open for anybody to, you know, to raise questions, and we are prepared to answer that. We are actually seeking for assistance within any country and any organization within SADC to ensure that the democratization of Swaziland is as peaceful as everybody wants it to be.
Now, we've seen different governments and states across the world seemingly accepting states such as Rwanda and Ethiopia, where there still aren't certain freedoms, and the governments there have quite a very strong hand, and especially against the opposition. But governments around the world seem to accept this while these states are able to develop the living standards of their countries. But in Swaziland, it doesn't seem like there is the same level of development. What sort of conditions are the Swazi people facing at the moment?
Well, firstly, I think the approach, the perspective from which the international community views a peaceful, stable country or state, I don't, you know, agree with that. Because if somebody says that a country is stable, the economy is growing, there is no war, that is not a sign of peace.
Mm-hmm.
People, there could be no war in a country, but you'll find that there is no peace. People are being suppressed because they are not allowed to express themselves freely.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I believe that economic freedom alone is not the answer for peace in a country. And political freedom alone is not the answer for peace in a country. It is jointly politics and economy and the social stability of a country cannot be separated. And that may be so in those countries. I know Ethiopia is one of the most improving in terms of the economy. But people are poor. People are leaving Ethiopia and they are running away to escaping to Europe. Why is it so?
Mm.
It is because the poverty in that country, the economy in that country is not, you know, equated accordingly. There are obviously very rich people and very poor people. Indeed, even in Swaziland, Swaziland is regarded as a middle-income country. But you know that about 68% of the people of Swaziland live below the UN poverty data.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that does not mean that people in Swaziland are therefore happy because they are not as poor as some people in some other places. We believe that the economy of Swaziland must be shared accordingly to all the people of Swaziland. We believe that Swaziland belongs to all the people of Swaziland. As it is now, the share of the economy, of the wealth of Swaziland, is too lopsided. Most of the people who are nearer to the royal household are more wealthier than others. People in the rural areas are very poor. There are people who haven't had a meal in the last 3 days in Swaziland.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people in the royalty are very affluent. And therefore, I believe that, you know, because of the suppression of the views of the people, people are not as yet ready to vociferously come up to say they can change.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that people of Swaziland are happy. I was talking about the European Union as against the Cotonou Agreement, for instance. The Cotonou Agreement states it clearly that the partnership of the European Commission with the African Caribbean states is based on the respect for fundamental human rights and democracy. And, you know, that because there is no instability in the country does not mean the country is free and peaceful.
Now, Mario, I just wanted to ask you our final question before we let you go. Can you just tell us a little bit about your bail conditions? I think I've read that if you do speak out, you might be arrested again, but I've seen that you've addressed a church group already, and obviously you're speaking to us here now.
Yeah. The issue is in Swaziland, the bail conditions are that we may not address public gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
We have to submit all our travel documents and passports. We have to report to the nearest police station once a month. Now, you know very well that that if we abide by the condition that we do not address any public gathering, that is a questionable thing. But as of now, that is being addressed by our legal department. However, what is a public gathering? What is an address?
Mm-hmm.
That has to be determined by a court. But surely, if I meet 20 members of my family and I tell them how my prison experience has been, definitely that means I would be arrested because that is a public.
Mm.
Is that a public or is it a private gathering? It is up to the courts to declare. But I am saying that is in the hands of our legal team.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who looks in this, it means we are now going back years and years back, where the suppression of freedom of expression, freedom of association, and so forth is being now embedded and confirmed by a court of law. But again, it must be clear that contravention of the conditions, then you are subject to arrest, mm-hmm. charge for contempt of court.
Mm-hmm. Mario, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. That's Mario Masuku, the leader of Podemo, the Swaziland's banned opposition party. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are welcome, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. You're listening to Daily Maverick. My name is Greg, and I'm joined by my colleague Fatima. I think in a second we're going to turn to looking at initiation practices. Oh, okay, and we've got Nkosi Mahlangu from the National House of Traditional Leaders, the Deputy Chairperson, on the line. Nkosi, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you, and I want to say good day to you, too.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Nkosi, over recent years, of course, we have seen the issue of initiation schools, particularly the deaths and injuries that lead to amputations and whatnot, being of great concern. And I think the issue here is not that we need to, you know, get rid of initiation schools or anything like that. And actually, I recently read an article that was quite touching, where I think it was from the Daily Dispatch in Eastern Cape, where an old man had finally been able to get his son, who has some disabilities, I think he had a 40-year-old son with disabilities, he was able to get him through an initiation school. And the old man now said he can die because he can die happy because his son has finally become a man, he's finally been initiated. And for me, that really touched on the point that it's important to make these initiation schools work and be safe for the young men going through them. And I just want to ask you today a little bit about coming into this winter initiation season this year. What were some of the key goals and some of the key aims and programs that were introduced to improve safety?
I think what we have done, we share the same sentiments, that it's a serious concern that boys are losing their lives year in, year out. But I think from 2013, as traditional leaders, as the National House, and working together with the Department of Traditional Affairs, we've worked very hard to try to stop the carnage, to stop these deaths and also the amputations that go around it. We came up with what we called a 12-point plan. Mm-hmm. Firstly, that 12-point plan, it spoke about the fact that each and every boy that goes to initiation school must go through medical pre-screening, that there should be no boy that is allowed to go without pre-screening. We said there must be proper application for running an initiation school where traditional leaders would become accountable for the schools that they've given permission to. There'll be monitoring teams that are going to be established in each and every province just to make sure that everybody adheres to the rules, that we get the Department of Health involved, we come up with an integrated monitoring team that would comprise of the National Public Health Authority, that would have the Department of Health, the municipality, traditional leaders, that would be going to these initiation schools just to make sure that everything is safe, that traditional surgeons should be properly trained and properly registered, that medical doctors should also be allowed to play a role, especially on the surgical part. And it's been quite a number of improvements. Because if you look back in 2013, we lost 116 boys that year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we were able to, the number was brought down to below, just below 50. And this year, the national figure stands at 33, even though our plans was to have zero deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we still had quite a number of illegal schools. Despite having come up with a policy, a national initiation policy, of which I think a policy we're all aware that it's a bit difficult to implement a policy because it's not a law. But we pushed that provinces should implement some of the prescripts that are there in the policy just to make sure that we prevent the deaths of boys and that we clamp down on bogus initiation schools, of which most of these deaths, I think 85% of the deaths that we've seen have happened at illegal initiation schools. And where you find that at the legal schools where they may have been casualties, either it was natural causes. If not, there was some case of abuse where the police have come in and they've arrested those that are perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
Together with the Deputy Minister, we propose that the Criminal Procedure Act should be amended whilst we are still working on the national framework on initiation, just to make sure that when we reach the December season of initiation, illegal schools are completely criminalized. You know, anybody that is found to be running an illegal school should be arrested, because we saw a serious mushrooming of illegal schools in Gauteng, mainly where we had over 100 illegal initiation schools. In the Eastern Cape, we also had approximately 200 illegal initiation schools. So we had quite a number of illegal initiation schools, of which it was a very scary number.
Mm-hmm.
So now we are saying the law must bite a bit more, so that we discourage those that have seen this culture as a way of making money.
So it seems that the screening and monitoring of legal initiation schools has been improved, and that's led to a better situation in terms of the health and safety of these boys. But just tell me, so now we're looking at changing the Criminal Procedures Act to be able to prosecute the organisers of illegal and unregistered initiation schools. But what does the current law entail? Does it mean that people who currently hold illegal initiation schools can't even be prosecuted?
Look, it has been very difficult to prosecute them because provinces, it's only now that we've pushed that each and every province has come up with with legislation. I think Mpumalanga was the first where there is a legislation that has serious implications for those that are running illegal schools. You've got the Eastern Cape that is currently amending its legislation, of which it did not talk to the criminality of illegal schools. We've had the Limpopo Circumcision Schools Act also came short of coming up with ways and measures of arresting those that are running illegal schools, even though the Limpopo Act was clear in terms of determining different roles of each and every person that is involved within initiation. That's why we saw in Limpopo, I think they've been recording zero deaths in many years. Unfortunately, that this year we've had three people that have died this year. But in Limpopo, it has always been a shining example. Mm-hmm. But we've seen those deaths happening at illegal schools, you know, and they've been doing very well in terms of closing them down. And, but they were closing them down, and people that were perpetrators were not arrested, you know. So in Mpumalanga, we have 32 people that are currently going through court now where they were arrested because of the death that happened in 2013. You know, so it's only now that we are seeing the law starting to bite on issues around initiation. I think you'd be aware that even traditional leaders, you know, because of the changing of laws and all those, we still have the traditional courts bill that is still before, that is still supposed to be enacted now. Mm-hmm. They can't do much, you know, because there is nothing that gives them power to be able to act against those that are people that are perpetrators, you know. So the law has been caught napping, where we have people that are taking advantage of the gaps that they were seeing within the system.
And Nkosi, are you, although now we're seeing a reduction in the amount of deaths, and hopefully soon we'll get more prosecutions for those guilty for illegal initiation schools and for responsibility for these deaths, but are you confident that we can continue this reduction? Will it be a number of years and we might even see no deaths in initiation schools? Could that actually happen?
Look, I am confident. I have a meeting tomorrow with initiation forums from different provinces where we are identifying problems. Because, I mean, the initiation season just ended yesterday, the 27th. So, and already on the 29th, we're having a meeting where we are doing a sort of like a post-mortem in terms of what are the challenges, what is it that we can do. So we are starting to plan now for next year, you know, just to make sure that by the time the December season and the June, the winter season comes, we are already well set up. We've come up with strategies of how we're going to deal with illegal schools. And so we are working very hard to make sure that we have zero deaths. That's my dream. That's the minister's dream within COFTA. And I'm sure it's each and every South African's dream that, you know, we will have our boys going to education schools, coming back alive, not only coming back alive, but coming back alive with their manhood feeling back. So, in some of these illegal schools, with the boys circumcision, people are losing their manhood, you know, and it's something that we want to deal with, because I think we have seen where problems are, especially in the Eastern Cape, because it is in the Eastern Cape where you find amputations. You don't find amputations in any other province. So we are starting to identify some of the problems that are leading to these amputations, and which is what we are clamping down on.
And just on that, so often we talk about the deaths, but there isn't often as much focus on these boys who suffer from complications during the circumcision process and then have to go through an amputation. I remember a couple of years ago I interviewed one such boy, and he said he obviously went to the initiation school because he wanted to be a man, and that was, you know, what was expected of him, and that was his hope. But then when he went back to his community after having his manhood, I guess, amputated, he said he suffered from serious isolation within the community and a lot of stigma. I'd imagine that process as well leaves a lot of young boys traumatized.
No, true. It is true. That's why we are getting traditional leaders involved. We are getting the communities involved. I mean, one of the things that we've identified as the National Trust Group was that we've been talking to leaders mainly that have not been going down to communities. So now the plan is, that's why we're starting so early, that we need to get to the communities, address community meetings, get youth structures involved, because it is mainly the youth that is putting pressure on some of these people that may have not gone to initiation schools, and they're also putting pressure to people that have done medical main circumcision, that we need to start addressing them, you know, talking to them, getting involved in in serious campaigns targeted at young people, because we've seen they are the ones that are causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And also within the communities, I mean, if you look at where in the OR Tambo district of the Eastern Cape, I mean, we've lost 20 boys this year just in that area.
Mm.
It is because the practice was stopped a long time ago, and it is the young boys that went to initiation schools recently. They are the ones that are running initiation schools, and that is killing a lot of boys, because you're finding a lot of inexperienced people that are involved in the practice. And so we've decided that we need to go there, address communities, address these young boys, and start coming up with systems, you know, in those communities. That would deal with how people relate with one another,
mm-hmm.
you know, address the issues of social cohesion,
mm-hmm.
in those areas, because it's what impacts on the stigmatization that we are seeing within those communities. So there'll be a lot of even door-to-door campaigns. There'll be a lot of addressing of community meetings and going to soccer tournaments and having young that are driven by the National House, where there are soccer tournaments. After those soccer tournaments, where we talk to these boys,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to, you know, to make them realize the severity of the problems that they are facing. You know, because I don't think that even if I'm a young boy, I would want to see my brother suffering the way people are suffering.
I don't think anyone wants to see the suffering continue. And Kossi, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you don't mind if we stay in touch with you on this issue.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much.
Cheers.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye. That was Nkosi Mahlangu from the National House of Traditional Leaders. He's the deputy chairperson there. You're listening to the Daily Maverick Show. My name is Greg, and I'm with my colleague Fatima here. Now, we're going to stick with the issue of initiation schools and some of the health challenges facing young boys in the recent winter season. Fatima, it's intense stuff, huh?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any sort of, I guess you've grown up around Joburg and things like that. You don't know any young men have been through initiation schools and those practices. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. It just seems like a very tricky issue because obviously it's something that a lot of boys want to do to become men, and they identify strongly with the practice.
Mm.
But at the same time, it seems like there's need for a lot of regulation, and there's a lot of issues when it comes to culture and then introducing outside people, outside forces to regulate that practice.
Like government regulators, medical doctors.
Exactly. So and I think a lot of people have an issue with bringing in medical doctors into a cultural practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just, I think the story I mentioned to Nkosi Mahlangu, it's heartbreaking, I think, though, the negative effects of when circumcision at initiation schools go wrong. You know, I did a little bit of work on this a couple of years ago, and there was a doctor actually that put out the pictures of what happens and the different complications after this period. And so in terms of the circumcision, you need to make sure the wound, or I guess what it is wrapped and things, and many of these supposed traditional healers or the medical practitioners doing this didn't know how to do that properly. So often they would wrap it much too tight. Mm. They wouldn't change the dressing frequently enough. For the circumcision practice, they would use things like those stories of using the same razor blade for each young boy. Those stories of using broken glass for the circumcision practices. Then there are stories as well of just general poor health practices, particularly in some of these illegal initiation schools, where so after the operation is performed, of firstly not dressing and caring for the wound properly, then doing things like in the
the tent, if you will, where the boys were staying, keeping them there where it was extremely hot, not giving them enough water, not giving them sufficient food to recover from these things, and then also putting them through quite a vigorous program of maybe toughening up is the best words. Obviously, I'm not using the proper terminology, but I guess quite strict practices while they're at the mountain or wherever, you know. So I found those things quite shocking. And then this boy who I spoke to had gone through a process of having to have his penis amputated. And he mentioned things like, and the story's out there and it's been published, he mentioned things like, because the community found this out, you know, he went through this ordeal and everybody knew about it. So they did things, you know, teasing him, he'll never be with a woman, he'll never be a man in his life. They'll push him into a room full of girls and just lock the door and say, you know, oh, you can't do anything to them. Things like that. So this boy, I think he was also, for a little bit, he was suicidal. Facing just all these sorts of pressures of the going to become a man and then having his manhood taken away from him and then being ostracized from his family and the community for that. And it's just quite shocking. I think some of the interventions Kosi Mahlangu was talking about will hopefully regulate that industry and allow the practice to continue, but to continue safely.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty impressed by the statistics that he mentioned, how they've reduced the deaths.
Okay, I think in a moment we're going to be starting to wrap up, but Fatima, you just want to tell us a little bit about your highlights from the EFF conference on the weekend, you know, hitting it for the first time. How was it? Do you have a favourite struggle song?
I don't yet, but I
probably... Oh, no, I hear you're singing Futsak.
Yeah, it was really fun. I think there's a lot of areas in life where you have to be really professional and put together. And I think for once you can just say what you want. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really enjoyed about the rally. I think it's really interesting to see how a party like the EFF has made people more interested in politics in general.
Particularly young people.
Exactly. I mean, I have never been to a rally. I probably wouldn't have voted if there was an EFF. Because I wouldn't have cared. I watch Parliament now. I know
the best reality TV out there.
It really is. So yeah, a lot of highlights.
But do you think after? So you obviously they came on the scene with a big bang. Sort of started when Malema initially went to the Marikana. Went to Marikana after the massacre, and then he sort of built up his. He was outside the ANC, built up his sort of credibility, and ended up with this big thing called the EFF. And that was just, I think it was like 8 months before the election, whirlwind tour. And then since then, they've been causing a stir in Parliament, you know, obviously with the Malema's general popularity and with the controversial things he and his fellow fighters are prone to saying. They get a lot of attention, they've had a lot of build-up. But do you think that can hold? Do you think there's still that focus, or that people will, ahead of perhaps the next elections, the local elections next year, people will start to lose interest?
I think it's important to be controversial in the beginning to get that attention. I mean, I am pretty interested in what they're doing now. And once you realize that it's not all controversial statements and you start to hear about their policies, maybe that's kind of the hook. And people will continue to be interested in what the party's doing.
I think that will be their challenge in terms of, number one, just keeping up the general interest while in the background. They've had to do a lot of, and they should be doing a lot of, just groundwork in terms of setting up branches, regions, provinces, because that really is the backbone of a political party, and they don't have the ANC's history with those structures all across the country that can mobilize for elections. So that's going to be interesting to see coming up to next year's elections. But that's all we have time for today. Thank you to my colleague Fatima Matiba for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Greg.
Thank you also to Nkosi Mahlangu from the National House of Traditional Leaders, Mario Masuku, the leader of the Swaziland political party PUDEMO, and briefly Patrick Dakwa on the line from the Eastern Cape to talk about initiation practices. Make sure you hit up our Twitter account at DMShowZA and download the podcast and subscribe and share with all your friends. Thanks for listening.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.